Welcome to Be Simply. This is she, and I want to thank you for joining us today. We have special guest Wuda calling in from Taiwan. He is a tea master, an ordained Zen monk, and today we're going to talk about many things, including tolerance, anger, presence, and how different practices, including tea, can assist us in further cultivating our inner landscape. Without further ado, let's dive in with Wuda. So Wuda, I want to thank you for being here today. I was excited to have this conversation because it feels right now that on a global level and just in my local community, we're really getting to see aspects of people's suffering in the sense of what they can tolerate and what they can't. And I thought maybe we could dive in with some of your point of view on the value of having tolerance and what's on the other side of situations when maybe you can't see another person's perspective.
Well, thank you for having me again. It's always wonderful to talk to you privately and publicly. Tolerance is one of the six perfections in Buddhism. It's one of the paramitas, they're called, which you could think of like, my teacher used to say, they're kind of like buckets that we're here to fill. That's like part of our journey is filling these six aspects of our saintly qualities. They're qualities of a saint, and we all have them in us. So we're just here to like cultivate them, refine them, or fill them up. And there's no doubt that if everyone in the world was more tolerant to the differences of others, this would be a much more merry place indeed. My first kind of teacher in my life was my great uncle. And he was a really amazing man. The kind of man that literally had thousands of people at his funeral. And the kind of man that was also like a simple hero. He was an insurance salesman. He wasn't like a rock star, but he was just a beautiful human being that touched a lot of people's lives in a lot of different ways, all extremely positive. And he used to say, if all was known, all would be forgiven. If all was known, all would be forgiven. And, you know, for decades that has echoed through all the chambers of my heart and come to mean different things at different times. Most powerfully, I think it means that when we understand where others are coming from, then we find empathy and compassion very easy. I think one of the dangers of this modern world is that the internet and other new forms of communication sometimes put people at a distance from each other. So they can use their Facebooks or their emails or whatever to communicate, and you're not looking in the eyes of another person. And so there's like anonymity, and there's an ability to lash out and to say things that you wouldn't say if you were looking at a person in the eyes. Or even maybe you would say those things, but you wouldn't say them in that way, with that tone or with that like amount of hostility or etc. So I think it's because of that, it's important for those of us who are conscious and cultivating ourselves to definitely work on understanding and compassion and tolerance towards others and towards the differences of others and towards understanding that we're all kind of doing the best we can with what we have. So, you know, my teacher always used to say that if a shark bit off your uncle's leg, on the one hand, that's a tragedy. On the other, he's lucky to be alive. But he would say it's only a madman like Captain Ahab in the novel, Moby Dick, that would chase the shark. Because the shark is just doing what sharks do. It didn't have a personal grievance towards your uncle. It was either hungry, so it ate his leg, or it was defending itself or its territory or something. I think the point that he was making is just that, like, sharks do what sharks do. And different kinds of people do what different kinds of people do. And they do what they do based on the confines of their consciousness, so how awake they are, and also due to their experience and their enculturation and their education. And so being angry at a shark for being a shark is silly, right? So one of my favorite Chinese sayings that that I carry often and say to my students very often, it's amongst my favorite, is the madman Li walks through the village shouting at his ducks because they won't roar. Right? So ducks quack. I think in terms of changes in politics and elections and these kind of things that that you're hinting at when you bring up this topic, I think it's also really important to remember that we don't have this world. It doesn't have really environmental problems, climactic problems. It has human problems. Mm-hmm. And human problems aren't political. They're not economic. They're in the heart.
Yeah.
They're in the heart of every person. And then societies are just groups of persons, of individuals. And as Gandhi said, if one person falls, the whole world falls by just that much. And if one person rises, the whole world rises by just that much. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, if you spill a single drop from a bucket, that still is one less drop you have in that bucket. And if you put a drop in the bucket, that's one more drop you have in the bucket. And so looking to the government to solve problems of the heart, problems of disconnection from each other and from nature, and trying to use argument or anger or intolerance to achieve goals like environmental protection is counterproductive. Mm-hmm. Because and I'm throwing a lot of quotes out, but they're just coming to mind today. Another one of my favorite quotes is by Ursula Le Guin, one of my favorite authors. And she says, that which you resist persists. Mm. So the more that I shout at the owner of the slaughterhouse, the more entrenched in his views he becomes. Mm. The more I understand his perspective, the more I understand potentially to awaken him to what he's doing, but he has to experience that. There's no arguments, there's no intellectual argument that's going to work. It's not environmentalism as a philosophy is beautiful, but as a philosophy, it will have to compete with other very powerful human forces like greed and ego and attraction to power. These are all also very powerful unconscious forces that exist in every single one of us, myself very much included. As a philosophy, as an intellectual idea, as a concept, we should protect the earth. Those are just words. And as a concept, I don't know that that concept's strong enough to compete with those forces.
Right.
But the experience of the very real truth that we are nature, that the trees are as essential to your survival as any of the organs in your body, that half or more of your sun's body is made of water, right? And so if I have a syringe full of pollutants, full of poison, and I go to inject your sun, you immediately protect him. You immediately stand between me and him. And that happens instinctually. It's not like it's you need a philosophy for that. You don't need an idea in your mind for that. You, as a mother, you automatically step between me and him.
Right.
But if I squirt that same syringe into his drinking water, you don't do anything. It's really not that different, unless the water's somehow clean before he gets it. But these days, who can say?
Right.
So why don't you do anything? Why don't you instinctually stand between me and the water when half of his body is water,
right?
And the reason is because when I approach him, you feel the connection. When I approach the water, it becomes indirect and you don't feel that triangle. You don't feel that connection, that stop in the middle.
Right.
Some people don't. So this is for me, and I certainly don't think that tea is the only medicine in the world that is capable of doing this or even necessarily the most important one. But this is where tea comes in for me, because I think that tea is a very powerful way of restoring that feeling of connection to nature, to the water, to the mountains, to the trees. And when people experience that, when I can give that experience to that person, then there's no need to tell them. There's no need to say, hey, so experience is everything. It's just like if you've ever been homeless in your life, you won't walk by homeless people on the road. And you won't. Only someone who doesn't have any understanding of the homeless lifestyle would say things that you commonly hear, like, don't give them money, they'll spend it on alcohol.
Right.
Like, if you've ever slept outside in the cold, where the difference between sleeping and not sleeping on any given night is a little bit of alcohol, you wouldn't say that.
Right.
Or maybe the difference between, just complete pain and mild pain. It's not even no pain. It's just like sheer pain and slightly less sheer pain is some form of medication. Then you wouldn't say things like that. So this is, I think, part of what my uncle was saying when he said, if all was known, all would be forgiven. It's kind of like the cliche, if you walked in a mile in somebody's shoes, you would know where they're coming from, and you'd know why they think the way they do. And that understanding is very, very helpful. In Buddhism, we have a really powerful exercise for this. So if you have someone in your life, like, you know, for me, for example, my beautiful, genius, amazing, wonderful father has very different views from me. Like many people, do we have a generation gap, you know? And so I practice this with him as well, but not just with him. So it's called compassionate listening. And the idea is just to listen to someone without, even if they're completely wrong, even if they're saying 2 + 2 = 5, even if they're saying something racist, that people of this ethnicity are worth less than this, or, you know, it doesn't matter what ideas they're expressing. The objective of compassionate listening is just to listen and be present and create loving kindness. So you create a space of love, you create a space of, you're like holding space for them and allowing them to speak what they feel without the intention of correcting them or battling them or being argumentative, but just holding space for whatever view they have without taking it on yourself. So, and this is a really powerful exercise, not only for that person, but for you as well. And see what happens when you practice this. See what happens when you also just the act. There's an implication in this, that there's another practice hidden in this, which is that you're postponing your attempts to like educate them or uplift them to another time. And just by postponing, you're creating like more space for them to have a process. You're creating more patience and tolerance, like which is the topic that you want to discuss today. So you're creating patience and tolerance just by postponing. So, and this could be to do with anything. Like, let's say hypothetically, because you mentioned in our private discussion earlier, your daughter's going to high school now. Let's say during high school, and this is a very real possibility for yourself and many other parents out there probably listening, that your daughter maybe dates someone for a period, short or long, that you don't approve of or you don't really like. And it's a Tuesday, and you're feeling like he did something recently or she said something that is bringing your disapproval of this person she's dating to your mind.
Right.
So it's arising, your trigger. Your trigger's arising, and you feel compelled to discuss it with her, to say, hey, this, you know, right? But instead, you make a conscious decision to postpone that.
Right.
Right. You're doing a few things. You're allowing space and room for tolerance and patience. You're, number two, you're allowing the charge to dissipate. Because whenever you're charged, that is a if you're a practitioner, you know, my teacher used to talk a lot about this. The moment you're emotionally charged about anything, that should be a surefire sign that this is the inappropriate time to discuss it.
Right.
Right. So in Buddhism, we talk about like finding the self and holding composure. in Zen, you'll see Zen teachers talking about this often, many Zen teachers. And it's about that. It's about kind of finding that place where you can't get knocked off balance, where you're not knocked off balance by other people's views or emotions or whatever they're doing, their ego. And B, you're also not knocked off balance by this stream of emotions and thoughts that are happening inside of you.
Right.
And when you can hold that composure, that's holding that composure, one could say, is the practice of Zen.
Yeah.
And being able to hold that compression through that composure through all activities in life, that is the practice of Zen. That's what we're definitely like striving for and working towards. So by postponing and just listening, right, you're creating space for tolerance and empathy. You're creating space for the charge to die down, because it's so much more skillful. You can be so much more effective when you're not charged, because when you're charged, your daughter most likely subconsciously, unconsciously, is going to pick up on the fact that you're charged.
Or quite overtly.
Right. So what that's going to do is create defensive mechanisms in her. And so everything you do try to say to her is going to have to pass through those defensive mechanisms, which are going to filter it. And it's not really going to be effective or reach her, because she's going to be in defense mode because she can feel the fact that you're charged. And this doesn't just go for our daughters or loved ones. It goes for, you know, anyone. With the moment you approach someone with a charged demeanor, they immediately become defensive, and what you have to say isn't going to really be that effective. And it can actually have the alternative effect, like I said, but in making them become more entrenched in those views.
Right.
Because the more you push them, the more they kind of dig in.
Absolutely.
Right. So I think postponing and just listening is the practical tool that corresponds to this paramita of tolerance. The paramita of, and this is what my uncle was saying, because I don't like to, you know, I'm Zen, so I don't like to like just talk about abstract philosophical principles without actual practical applications that you can utilize in your life.
Right.
And I think the practical application of tolerance, which is, tolerance is an ambiguous perfection of saintly people, and it sounds great, let's all be tolerant, but how do we get there?
Right.
And so one of many, there are many, many practical tools that we can use to get there, but one very important one, I think, is to cultivate one's listening skills. Listening to others, that's what I was saying when my uncle said, if all was known, all was be forgiven, and I've repeated over and over again about how empathy is so important and understanding. All of that happens through listening. And listening is one of the, in my personal practice and personal path and journey through life, I think the two absolute most important skills that I try to cultivate, and if I can get these two things down before I leave this earth, I'll be quite content to go. And one is just that, listening, and the other is honoring. So if I can listen and I can honor, and I don't mean just listen to others, I mean listen to nature, listen to the universe as it tries to teach me, which is the basis of all learning. Scientists are trying to listen to nature to understand the way that nature works. I'm doing the same, but in self-cultivation, I'm listening to myself mostly, and I'm also listening to my environment. But if I can listen and I can honor, revere, respect, whatever word you want to use for that one, right? But
right.
Honor is a really good word.
Yeah.
If I can honor and treasure what I hear, first I got to hear it, and then I have to honor it.
Right.
And if I can do those two things, you know, for me, those are the big leaps. So listening is a very, very powerful tool towards tolerance, listening to others. And it's not easy. It's a big challenge. Emerson said something beautiful. He said, it took me 5 years to learn to speak the English language and 52 to learn to hear it.
So with that word honor, and as you were speaking, it was bringing up connecting to anger. So, you know, when we have that charge internally and want to lash out at someone else or convince someone of, you know, our point of view because it's quote unquote right. Can you share a little bit about how you would recommend from your perspective to really understand that anger that might be coming up from within and how to honor it and move forward with it?
Yeah, I think it's inauthentic spirituality to be opposed to anger. Anger is not an issue. Anger is actually, in many ways, beautiful. When we get angry, we actually become more sensitive, more sharp, more present. And presence, I mean, who doesn't want more presence? When you're angry, you're pretty present. Like you're in your body, you're focused, you're awake. So anger is not the issue. The issue is violence. And when I say violence, I mean any reaction that comes out of anger. The violence could be in the form, obviously, of physical violence, but I don't just mean physical violence. I mean also verbal violence. Mm-hmm. And I also mean, because I'm a Buddhist, mental violence.
Yeah.
So even internally having a violent reaction towards you, or verbally, or physically, let's just call all that violence, because it all is a form of violence. It's just more or less subtle or more or less gross, but all a form of violence. And it's the violence that's the issue, not the anger. Anger is just an emotion and energy that passes through us, right? So it's the violence that's the issue. So anger, you know, anger is just something that is a part of being human. Right. And the idea is to turn it into compassion, to turn it into understanding, to work with it. I think as you become more and more self-aware, some things about anger that become really clear is that before the violence, this is a weird thing. I can't explain it other than to say that it is, because it sounds almost like time magic or something, but... Before the violence even happens, oftentimes, if the violence is coming, I've noticed that I already start suffering before it comes.
Right.
And if I'm in a state where I can hold space for the anger and honor it, which is to hold space for it, and the violence isn't going to come, I don't suffer. But the queer thing, the strange thing, is that I suffer before it even happens. Ordinarily, we think of cause and effect as in the effect follows the cause.
Right.
But I've actually noticed many times that if there's a violent reaction coming, whether it's mental, verbal, or physical, that I already start suffering before it comes. Like I'm already burning. I'm already I'm already feeling it. It's the pain of it, you know? And there's definitely an understanding that I'm the first victim of it. And so I think honoring it is allowing it to be, first of all, you know, in Zen, one of the old Zen sayings is whatever comes through the door.
Right.
So it's just like, you know,
It's here.
It's like an old, it's like an old Civil War dude waiting for the enemies to show up, and he's just sitting inside with his shotgun. I mean, that's kind of the Zen approach. It's just, whatever comes through the door, I'm going to face it. And it's all, there's nothing, the door's unlocked. So whatever comes into this space, I got room for it.
Right.
And I think that's awesome, is to when you begin to realize over time as you practice that you have so much more space than you ever think you do, because you are really an unlimited being,
right?
And the walls are walls of the mind, as the Heart Sutra says. So the Bodhisattva lives without walls of the mind and thus without fears. Right? That's the line in the Heart Sutra. The Bodhisattva lives without walls of the mind and thus without fears. So the walls are walls of the mind. People create walls and say, I don't have the space for that experience. I don't have the space for, you know, I could never, people, you know, I was just doing a Zen retreat, 7-day Zen retreat in the Pyrenees. And after the retreat, the owner of the retreat center was talking about how, like 50 or 100 years ago, some of the villagers crossed the Pyrenees without any modern mountain equipment. Isn't that crazy? He said, I would never do that. And I thought, you know, I understood what he was saying. He was just like showing respect for these people that had endured things, right? Which is important. But on the other hand, like, yes, you could. Right? If you had grown up in that time when people walked across mountains without mountain gear, like, yes, you could. You have a capacity in you that's way beyond what you think.
Right.
So actually right here, in this is my workspace right here, I have a quote right here that I love a lot. It's by Muhammad Ali. A reporter asked him, how many push-ups do you do in a day? And his answer was, I don't know, because I don't start counting until I want to quit.
Nice.
So, and that's very much a Zen kind of approach to me. So it's celebrating the fact that, like, you have a lot more capacity than you think you do. And so far, I've not plumbed the bottom of my capacity. Mm. And I suspect that all of us are infinite. That we have a lot more room. And that room is tolerance. That room is a kind of tolerance, right? And a kind of space. And so I think that's a big part of how we honor anger or other aspects of ourselves, is that we give them space. Mm. And when you give them space, magic happens.
Yeah. Oh.
Creating space for the experience is a, and then honoring it, listening to it, understanding it. That you're not going to pass through a human life without anger.
It's a lot of take out.
Right.
And then not developing some kind of inauthentic idea that, like, it's that it means you're bad because right. you were angry, or that spiritual people don't get angry because you went to some meditation class on Thursday and everybody was talking in soft, peaceful voices. Mm. So those people must not get angry. That's kind of like when you first start meditating and you're at, like, your first retreat and you, like, you're not supposed to, but you, like, look around the room and you're like, wow, they all look like Buddhas.
Yeah.
And my legs hurt so bad. And, like, inside is just this, like, raging storm. And then you feel like you're the only one. And they're all, like, just having this really blissful, peaceful experience. When actually, they're going through the same stuff that you're going through, right? Of course.
Yeah.
So, you know, any ideas that, like, anger is not going to be a part of your experience, or that it should not be a part of your experience, that's like step one, like get rid of those kinds of shames or inauthenticities, and just recognize that we all face anger, and there's a lot of tools out there. The best one is the most ancient one. I mean, meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation there's an old Chinese saying, right? Calm meditation subdues poison dragons of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Calm meditation subdues poison dragons of the mind. And, you know, sometimes it's not about, like, I like the word in Chinese is even better. It's not a battle. It's more of, like, my teacher used to say, you know, we, not all of our demons are defeated.
Mm.
Some of them we just live above their reach.
Mm.
So we learn to, like, build our house in the treetops where those demons can't reach anymore.
Right.
But they're still down there. Mm. They just can't reach us anymore, you know. We kind of learn to live above them. And I think giving space and listening and as much as possible not practicing nonviolence. So at least don't get physically violent if you can't help yourself from being verbally or mentally violent. Even better, don't say verbally abusive things and just keep it inside yourself. Even better, then don't react with violence at all and learn to just be onto anger. And I think my earlier practical advice is helpful in this instance too, of when you feel charged, postpone your desire to participate. Because when you're charged, your participation is not going to be effective for you or for others, and it's most likely just going to create a mess that you're going to have to clean up later. So it's always useful to like retreat, take a step back, and postpone. So that's what you can kind of, that's the postpone is the good word, because it's like kind of what you can use to, I guess, convince the egoic part of yourself.
Right.
Right. So the egoic part of yourself feels like this really strong compulsion. Back to my example, which was purely hypothetical, like your daughter's dating someone you don't like and you're feeling triggered, and postponing kind of satisfies the part of you that's triggered, because you're not letting go of the issue. You're saying, okay, I'll deal with it. Just not right now.
Right. Yeah.
And so right now, instead, what can I do? And the instead is I can listen to her. And it doesn't matter if she's wrong.
Right.
The most compassionate thing I can do for her is to hear her. Right? Because if I don't hear her, then I'll have no chance of reaching her. Right? If I don't understand where she's coming from. Right, like, and whatever that means, I don't know. In that instance, I've never experienced being a mom with a daughter who's dating someone. I don't know. So, I don't know what that means. Maybe seeing what she sees in him. I don't know. I mean, maybe just listening.
Yeah.
Just being a space of like, hey, you know, if more people in the world did this for each other, practiced this for each other. Holding space for other people to list, to speak, and you just listen. Instead of talking while they're talking, which sometimes means maybe not verbally, but like internally you're already talking while the person's talking and you're not really listening, not holding space to them, and allowing yourself to disagree, but still have the capacity to listen. Right. And just let the, you know, even if it's absurd what they're saying, and if they're saying 2 + 2 = 5 or some wrong thing, right? But just to be able to listen. I think this practice deflates a lot of negative energy, especially when you have people in conflict or something. You know, and this is used in just about every therapy in the world as well. Like, you know, when you go to therapy, Native Americans, not all tribes, but there was traditions amongst certain tribes of having a talking stick.
Yep.
So when they held council, only the dude with the stick can talk. And if you don't got the stick, then you're not permitted to talk at all. It doesn't matter what the dude with the stick is saying. He can be saying absurd things. He can be saying things that you completely disagree with or find to be an absolutely wrong course of action. But you still honor his voice, his space,
right.
His inherent worth on this planet and as part of the tribe, that like he has a voice, and we're going to honor that because of the basic fundamental humanity that demands that, hey, if I want my voice to be honored, then I have to honor the voices of others.
Absolutely. So if, you know, when you're talking earlier about matters of the heart, you know, when we're, we realize there's something internal that is ready to be, you use the word unpacked sometimes. If you can share with the listener what's possible when we meet that resistance within and how to access the beyond what we might think we know in that moment, whether it's attachment or an emotion.
Courage. This is, I mean, self-cultivation it's a very much a warrior's practice. Bodhisattva means warrior of enlightenment. Yeah. So warrior spirit is there. I mean, I'm a warrior of peace, but sometimes there's a spirit that needs to be, you need some courage. And courage some people sometimes confuse courage for fearlessness. And it's not. Courage is the answer to fear. So if I said to you, I went to the beach today, you would not say how brave of you. Right? But if I told you that maybe when I was a child, this isn't true, but hypothetically, there was some trauma and my father died in the ocean, drowned in front of me, and ever since then I've been deathly afraid of beaches, but today I went to the beach. Then your natural response would be what? How brave.
Right.
Right? Because courage is the answer to fear. And so confronting these things that are inside of us that are challenging to unpack or to face, there's no pill, there's no bumper sticker that can get there. You have to find the courage. And I find in myself and every human that I come in contact with, like earlier when I was talking about how our capacity is always way beyond what we think it is, and that the limitations are only limitations of the mind. I find that human beings are also, in the same way, way more courageous than they ever think they could possibly be.
Mm.
And that the limits of our courage is also unbelievable. I mean, if you just look, pick a direction in history or in the world now, and look at what humans have, how all the many, many, many ways that the human spirit has stood up to fear, to suffering, to death, to intolerance, to hatred, to and always triumphed.
Mm.
And always triumphed. So, I believe in the potentiality of that, and I believe in courage. And that's often, like most things, it's a matter of orientation. It's a matter of perspective. It's a matter of shifting your perspective and unpacking is just it's kind of like any job. No matter how big the job, it just starts when it starts.
Hmm.
Like you if you've got a week's worth of dishes and you keep postponing it because you think it's too big of a job, it's just it doesn't matter how big the job is. It starts. It's the starting of it that's really the challenge. Once you're in there, you find out this isn't so bad doing these dishes. Right, I heard a story once that has touched me really deeply about Amma.
Mm.
That and it doesn't matter to me if it's true or not, because it's such an inspiring story. But I wasn't there, so that's why I say that. But someone just told me this kind of secondhand that some kind of sewage pipe or something broke in the ashram.
Yeah,
and there was this flood of sewage back in the back of the ashram, and finally they didn't know what to do, and nobody would do anything with it, and they came to her and were what do we do? And she was take me there. And they were oh no, you can't go see it, it's really nasty. And she was no, take me now. And so they took her there, and there's a crowd of people there, and nobody knows what to do. They've shut off the pipe so it's not leaking anymore. Mm-hmm. But there's still this small lake of sewage that needs to be cleaned up. And, she kind of did a one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, four to go, and jumped into it and started bucketing it out. And once she did that, everybody did, and they cleaned it up in just a couple hours. Mm. So it was nobody wanted to start this terrible job.
Right.
But once it got started, it wasn't as bad as anybody thought it was going to be. It was over with, I mean, it wasn't a pleasant task, but things are often like that. It's all about the space. In Buddhism, we say making space for meditation is the primary meditation.
Mm.
I don't think it's a coincidence that most ancient cultures in the world use variations of the word cultivation to talk about spiritual growth, which is like a farming word. because in English, we say, I'm growing corn in my backyard. But that's actually not true. You don't grow corn. Right? Corn grows itself. God grows corn. You don't grow corn. Nature grows corn. Corn mm. grows. What you do is make space for corn to grow.
Mm.
So you cultivate the land. You can put the seed in. You can water it. And mostly, actually, what gardeners do is weed.
Right.
So in the same way, our insights and our spiritual practice, you will find that actually Dogen Zenji, who's the founder of my lineage in Zen, he said that when you reach the space, practice begins. Hmm. Some dopey people have interpreted this literally and like felt like he meant you have to go to Eihichi, like the temple that he founded, like it's, you know, so actual place you have to go to. But what he meant was that when the place of practice is there and you step into it, practice begins. So actually more of our efforts have to be concerted around making the space. Mm. Like the perfect analogy for me is exercise, because I'm fat and I'm in my spirit, a mountainous. I'm still. I like being still. Mm-hmm. And movement is harder for me. So this is the more one of the areas of my life I work on. But once I get to the gym, I like to go for walks. I like to do other exercise. But in the gym, I like that elliptical machine, that ski machine, because mm-hmm. I have, as you know, a terrible knee. Mm-hmm. I just broke my knee a few years ago. So on that machine, I can move really fast because it's smooth. Mm-hmm. And so once I get to the gym, you know, I put on some headphones and put on a little rock and roll and get on that machine and everything's great. And from the moment I walk into the gym until the moment I leave, there's no struggle.
Right.
It's actually quite pleasant once you get into it, right? So the struggle is getting to the gym. Mm-hmm. Once you get, we could take Dogen's words and we could translate them to this issue and say, right, once you get to the gym, exercise begins. Right?
Yeah.
When you walk into the gym, exercise begins. It's not a struggle. Right. The struggle is making the space for exercise in your life. Mm. The struggle is, in my case, I live in this teeny town in the mountains, so everything is like, the whole town's like 5 kilometers across. So literally the gym's like a kilometer.
Right.
But that kilometer sometimes is really hard to traverse. Right? But once I'm there, there's not an issue. Yeah. I step into the gym and the exercise begins. So in the same way, when I make space in my life for meditation, then meditation happens. Hmm. And more of my efforts have to be concerted around making space for meditation than efforts spent doing this meditation or that meditation or doing the actual meditation itself, right? Hmm. So people will spend years talking about how they want to go on a retreat. But once you get on the retreat, there'll be challenges, no doubt. But like the work just automatically starts when you arrive there.
Right.
It's the arriving there that's hard. So we have to learn to just cultivate space. Mm-hmm. We have to cultivate space in our lives for our highest self, for our practices, for the things we value, mm-hmm. whether they're matters of the heart or matters of the spirit, or even interpersonal matters. Like if you want to have a good relationship with your children, then you have to cultivate time to have a good relationship with your children. It seems silly, but it's actually, you know, challenging. It's especially in a very busy world. The equivalent of weeding of a gardener, as I said, the biggest job of the gardener is weeding. The equivalent of that in this instance is like removing distractions,
right?
So that you can have the time to spend together with people you love, or to work on yourself, or to just be at peace.
Yeah.
All that, I think, is really... So when it comes to spiritual work, what I'm saying very simply is focus your energy on making space for spiritual work. Or a better way of saying it would be focus more of your energy on making space for spiritual work, and I promise insights will happen. Growth will happen. The corn will just grow of itself. It's the nature of the corn. You just got to make space for it. Mm. Right? There is some science, right, about knowing some, like, what goes together. That's an important science, like to know that corn and squash goes together, but maybe corn and this other plant don't go together because the other plant will swallow the corn, right? Mm. Or the corn will swallow that other plant. So, you know, I don't know, just a random hypothetical example, maybe Zen meditation and Shiva Shakti dancing might not work together, right? I don't know. I don't practice that kind of dancing, but maybe those. So there is some science in like what you practice, not only in what can work together, but in what works best for you, mm. right? Do you want to have a tea practice? Do you want to have a Zen meditation practice? Do you want to do yoga? Like what works best for you and what you can combine with it, mm. right? There is some science in that. But that actually is secondary. As I said, making space for meditation is the primary meditation. If your practice is 5 minutes a week, it doesn't matter whether you combine Shiva Shakti dancing and yoga and flute and Zen meditation. It doesn't matter what you do if that's all it is.
Right.
So the primary is where we need to concert our efforts, where we need to put more of our practice, more of our cultivation, more of our time, is and more of our effort is in making space. And once you make space, like I said, I think that once you've done that, like 80 or 90% of the work is already done, right? And the other 10% is like, you know, it's downhill. You'll find, and more as time goes on. So once I'm in the gym, I put the headphones on, the rock music's there, it's downhill from here. I'm just going to get on the machine, and that exercise is just going to happen, and it's smooth. And as I said, 9 times out of 10, I actually end up enjoying it. So not only is it not a struggle, it's enjoyable.
Right.
So in the same way, I think, you know, the practice more and more as time goes on goes smoother and smoother, and it's more just about making time / space to practice, making that field to put your seeds in, and they'll grow on their own. And if you're not, if your garden's not, doesn't look the way that you want it to, you're probably not weeding it and cultivating space for it to look the way that you want to. And going and buying different seeds isn't going to help. Right?
Yeah.
So you have to weed it, you have to water it, you have to like keep the space there. And if you do that, things will grow. That's just it, because that's the nature of things. So I find I try to focus more of my efforts. I'm luckier than a lot of people because I have the blessing of living in a Zen center. So my space is kind of made for me in the sense that I live in a place with Buddhas around, and I also live in a place with a very strict schedule and strong discipline. So whether I like it or not, I'm going to meditate tomorrow morning because that's what's going on here.
Right.
And I'm obligated to do so. So I don't have the possibility of saying, I'll do that tomorrow.
Right.
So I'm fortunate in that way that I have this, you know, but we can all have that in the form of, you know, what in Buddhism we say is Sangha, which means like community, supportive community that helps charge us, helps remind us to make that space. So that's why it's important to also plug into your community and to plug into positive, inspirational discussions, like listening to this radio show, you know, and just being inspired by people, by others around us, whether they're distant or near, but connecting and finding inspiration so that we kind of recharge our batteries and we help each other in that way, because together we can definitely be something that any one of us can't be alone.
Absolutely. I want to like wrap this all around that Buddha back there that I asked you about, because he's really speaking to me right now. And it goes back to the beginning, really, about the tolerance. In currently, especially I've witnessed in a trend spiritual practice where people are like, I have to have boundaries, and they create separation versus potential integration of understanding and everything we've been talking about or you've been sharing. So if you could share a little bit about the power of, you know, really, you know, Bodhisattva's practice is really to take whatever's given and transform it, utilizing that energy and creating something for the betterment of all from it. So if you can share a little bit about that, where we can gain strength actually within people's suffering, we can find solutions, we can create forward motion, and we don't have to like push them into a compartment because they're not behaving the way we think they should.
Yeah. That, I mean, that, you know, that's like conditional tolerance or conditional loving. And you're going to be tested that way. You can't disconnect. So that's just the truth of the matter. There is no separation. That's an absolute fact, and truth is truth. You can argue with that reality, but it's not going to change the nature of it. The earth goes around the sun. You can say it doesn't, but it does. It's just the fact of the way things are. You are not separate, not from anything. Just as you are not ever, your actions are never separate either. Just because you do them in privacy doesn't mean they're not connected. Or, you know, because you think them and that you think that that's only in your mind. I think, again, it's not an issue of boundaries. That's a mistaken, it's just a wrong view. Because what it really is an issue of capacity, not of boundaries. Or perceived capacity, because I believe that we all, the walls are walls of the mind. They're not right. Real walls. But nevertheless, in the experience of that person, they've reached their capacity. And that understanding is much closer to the truth than saying that they need boundaries. They might need boundaries, but and maybe that is what needs to happen, is they need to have some boundaries or space. But understanding that that's only because of their capacity is important. Because that shifts responsibility from I need boundaries because of you to I need boundaries because of me.
Right.
I need boundaries because my capacity is not large enough to hold. It's different than saying I need boundaries because you suck. Right?
Yeah.
Which is a very weak lesson.
Yeah.
Right? It's a very kindergarten lesson if at the end of the day the lesson is Bob is a jerk.
Right.
Even if the whole world agreed that Bob was a jerk, which that's just not possible, because 8 different people look at Bob in 8 different ways. And even if 6 of those people do think he's a jerk, the reason they think he's a jerk is very different. And some people, you might find these really funny things where, like, you think Bob's a jerk when he is being antagonistic to you, but you actually think it's funny when he's doing it to others.
Right.
So, like, you know, it isn't, but even if the whole world agreed that Bob is a jerk, so he just is a jerk, then reacting towards that is kind of like reacting towards the rain. And then you're back to the madman Lee walks through the village roaring at, shouting at his ducks because they won't roar. Because if he truly was just the essence of jerkness, and your lesson at the end of the day is Bob's a jerk, what a weak lesson. That's like saying rain is rain. It's not, you know, what do we do with that? Right. What do I do with that jerkness? What can I, you know, what does it mean to me and to my practice? And so I think it's an issue of capacity and not an issue. And acknowledging that, just saying, like, even if you do need to retreat and you do need, like, a little space and a little bit of boundaries between you and a situation or you and another person, acknowledging that that's because you don't have the capacity to hold the situation, that's a, as they say, a horse of a different color. That means now that I'm retreating because, I'm taking responsibility for doing so.
Right.
As opposed to blaming you or saying that it's the world that's doing that. The Bodhisattva's secret weapon is, you know, the greater the challenge, the better. Sometimes I regret saying this, but the deepest truth inside, you know, my deepest prayer is bring it on. Tear me to shreds.
Yeah.
Tear it up. Like, just tear this. Tear it up. Tear it all up. And the better part of me is willing to shout that to the sky. And to turn all the suffering into medicine, to practice unconditional compassion, to face that part of me, because after years of meditation, I found what I suspect all of us have, which is this, like, secret compartment buried deep down inside. And in that secret compartment, I found this contract. And the contract was kind of like, in all these legal terms, I reserve the right to quit anyone or anything that doesn't satisfy me or serve me anymore. Yeah. And I found that that contract has done the person that I want to be, has done my highest self, my Buddha nature, my true self, me, much more disservice than it has done service.
Oh.
So I'm not saying it hasn't ever served me to make boundaries. And I'm not saying that no one should have, that there isn't as situations where, at least in terms of the world, where we have to extricate ourselves from a situation, right, or make boundaries or say no, or say no even strongly.
Right.
So I'm not saying that quitting every situation I've ever quit was always unhealthy. There are times when it was good. All I'm saying is that that contract has done me more ill than good. Hmm. It's done me more disservice than service, and that more of the time, when I just like you said, more of the time when I set up boundaries, I'm actually running away from the thing I need the most. I'm actually defending always. This is the most terrible thing about me. I'm always defending the part of me that I don't want to be. And I don't, that, you know, it's just the habit of being human. I think we all have some of that, but I'm always defending the worst parts of me. Until I like wake up from that and realize, you know, what are you defending? and what are you running from? And like, and this comes back to, then I find the opposite also in me. My master used to do this exercise, which might sound cheesy, but I think it's the good way to wrap it up. And I invite all of you to like honestly practice it, no matter how silly it might sound. And the doing of it is very different than the talking about it, actually. So it's like a contemplation, and it's very much imaginal. It's not meant to be any kind of like truth or reality. It's just an exercise. So he would say, you know, like, think of a time when you misbehaved, when you shouted at your beloved or your daughter because she's dating somebody you don't approve of.
I think you're being fortuitous.
Whomever, whatever the example is for any of you out there, sometime you reacted or you did something you didn't want to. And, like, think through the whole situation from beginning to end, how you felt, what your body language is like, you know, just like as much as you can remember about the situation. Like, you know, what was your body language as you were doing it? Where were you standing? Where were they standing? What kind of like expression was on your face? What did you look like? What did it feel like on the inside? As much as you can remember. And then he would say, imagine if, in our case, we were all Buddhists, so he would say the Buddha. But you could do this with Jesus or any saintly person or person you look up to, or even a mythical person, doesn't matter. Mm. So he would, this was in a Zen center, so he would use the Buddha. He would say, imagine the Buddha walked into the room like with a magic wand and took over your body, and you got to like step outside and watch his or her, depending on whoever's your example, I'm using the Buddha, so his, you got to watch him go through that same situation from the outside, right? And then he would ask you, and I invite you, you can do this in a journal, you can do it out loud, you can do it just in your head as a contemplation. Like, what would he have said differently? What would his body language have looked like? What would his facial expression have looked like? All the details. Imagine every little detail. And as a kind of spoiler, but I don't think the spoiler is any excuse to not do the exercise. It's a beautiful exercise. Give it a try. As a spoiler, it was amazing how intricately, how granularly people could describe, like how many details they could provide for how the Buddha would behave in that situation. Like I'm talking down to like minutiae of his body language, of where he would stand, of blah, blah, blah. And so after they had gone through this description where they had described how the Buddha would behave in all, in every way, my teacher would then kind of drop the Zen bomb by looking at them in the eyes and saying, "Have you ever met the Buddha?" "No." "Have you ever seen the Buddha?" "No." "So how did you know what he would do?" "Where did that come from, all those details?" Right? And when you experience this, you begin to realize, I have in me this saint, right? Because it's from my imagination is the answer. That's where it comes from. It comes from me. Because there's a part of me that knows what the saint would do. And that's the part of me that that's the part of me that's really worth defending, as opposed to the part that I usually defend, which is the worst part of me. So I've learned over time that when I get defensive, when I get, like you were saying, closed down, making boundaries, I'm often making boundaries around, I'm often defending the worst part of myself, not the best part. So I've learned that over time, and I've learned to use that as a signal. I've also learned, and this is the last thing, we can wrap it up. I've also learned something, which is, you know, if a castle has an impregnable wall, then how do you defeat the castle? You siege it, because then the castle's greatest asset, siege it means you surround it.
Right.
And it might even take a year. Some medieval wars took years because they would siege the castle for 2 years. But eventually, the people inside will run out of supplies and they will be forced to surrender. Because, you see, that defensive structure that is the castle's greatest asset also then becomes its enemy, because just as it keeps out things, it also prevents things from coming in. So armor is good in the sense that it protects you, but it's also bad in the sense that it prevents healing from coming in.
Right.
It prevents love from coming in. It prevents connection from coming in. It prevents listening from coming in. It prevents tolerance from coming in. It prevents it prevents nature from coming in. It prevents, you know, all of those things. So it is, there's a time, I wouldn't say never have the ability to harden or have armor. But I have found that most of the time, the armor, the castle wall, is built around the part of me that I don't want to defend.
Right.
and so realizing that myself, experiencing that for myself, has allowed me the insight that most of the time when I'm creating boundaries, they're not good boundaries.
Yeah.
And that it would serve the person that I want to be much better to tear them down, face the vulnerability of being open-hearted, and face the inevitable sensitivity and suffering that comes from being vulnerable and open. And that's the person that I want to be.
Yeah.
I want to be vulnerable. I want to be open. I want to be connected. I want to be in service. I want to put others before myself. I want to love more than I love. I want to forgive more than I'm forgiven, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm distant from those things, but I'm definitely oriented thus. So you I'm not sure, you know, how much even of the light I am. I have a combination of light and shadow, but I'm very certain that I love the light with all my heart. Yeah, I think opening is often can be painful, but we face it and we move on, and through it we transcend.
Buddha, I appreciate you and your wisdom, and I thank you for taking the time to share.
You're most welcome.
Once again, I want to thank Buddha for joining us today. As inspired, please connect to his work. The links are listed below. And in the sentiment of the Buddha that exists in all of you, we're going to exit out with the song that we entered with. And if you'd like to take a respite to explore your inner landscape, you can let the song, the mantra, the wisdom of the Buddha of compassion wash over you. Until next time, this is She signing out with a full heart, a soft gaze, a gentle smile, a deep bow, and a namaste. Be.